You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Otto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Networks, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, and this evening, my guest is author Andrew Dean, who has a new book coming out in April called Surfacing. I've had an opportunity to take a glimpse at it, and I got to tell you, it's pretty exciting. We'll be chatting about the book and what inspired this tale of intrigue, I guess you could call it, right after this first tune from Fervor Records called Pretty Monster by Reckless Serenade here on the Otto D Show. Check it out.
Carolina, there's no other fire. Paint the room with watching eyes. Carolina, I've been begging for you. Bite your lip, take me home tonight. I've been laughing in your sleep. What do pretty monsters dream of?
And that was Pretty Monster by Reckless Serenade here on the Otto D Show, which is brought to you in part by my good friends at Fervor Records and also by TheRecordingArtist.com, where every Wednesday evening I record bands live online while you watch. You can even participate via live chat if you want. So to learn more, visit TheRecordingArtist.com and be sure to watch our companion show on Amazon Prime called, you guessed it, The Recording Artist. It's pretty cool. And speaking of cool, my guest today is author Andrew Dean, who's got a new book, and I got to tell you, it is a real page turner. I can't wait to talk about it. So let's bring him on the show and get to it. Andrew, how are you doing, man?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming in.
No. Thanks for inviting me.
And then in all honesty, this show's usually live on Tuesday nights. We're doing a little pre-record because you and I have had a hell of a time matching our schedule over the last 4 weeks to
get this
together.
Yes, sir, we have.
And you've been in and out of Nashville a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
How come? Tell me what that's all about.
So my base camp of my film people are based in Nashville. So I'm splitting my time between there, working with them, trying to get the next feature off the ground, and then coming back and forth between Tucson, where I grew up, and my family's from. So I just enjoy Arizona more.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I introduced you as an author, and you started talking about a movie. So
yes.
Obviously, my intro cuts you a little short, huh?
No, it's fine. Like, I write. So, I mean, I'm a writer before I'm a movie maker.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just...
Well, how many screenplays have you written?
I've written 7.
Okay.
A weird tradition. I get a tattoo for every screenplay that I finish.
Awesome.
So none of them, they don't flow at all together. Like when other people that have tattoos, like
right.
My tattoos just don't look like they belong together. So after we did our first movie, we got crew tattoos. Everyone got matching ones except for the one on my neck.
Okay.
I started writing first, and then during COVID, you know, movie stuff came to a grinding halt.
Yeah, except for the writing, I guess, you know.
Exactly. And then I just thought about it, and I'm a huge Tom Clancy fan, and I had read one of his books again for probably his third time, and then I was like, well, let me try and turn one of my screenplays into a novel and see how that goes.
So this is your first novel?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I want to talk about the book, but you've sidetracked me already.
We'll go in whatever order you like.
I want to stay on the film for a second. You just kind of gave us a lot there, but... So you mentioned you grew up in Tucson.
Yes.
But most of your film people are in Nashville. You've written 7 screenplays. So where do I want to start with all that? Your first screenplay was just a few years ago, it sounds like?
Yeah, so I wrote it in 2016.
Okay. Did you go to school for screenwriting at all? Did you study it or did you just dive in?
I did. I went to school for it in Orlando.
Okay.
Yes.
Where at?
Full Sail.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And so when you wrote your first script, how did you feel about it when you got done?
I mean, you do your rough draft. I knew how to format it because there's a software that does everything
right.
for it. So it looks good on paper.
Right.
And then when, you know, you work up the courage to show it to your colleagues and, you know, you just get the initial Band-Aid rip off of like, well, this is terrible here, here, and here. But I had a good hot topic to go off of because it was during the Trump administration.
Okay.
So the backbone of the story was there. It was just learning how to, you know, put the bricks and the mortar together.
And that can be a process.
Yes, it can.
I mean, when I wrote my first screenplay with the right software, so it looked beautiful.
Yeah.
The first 3 industry people I gave it to said they couldn't get past the first page because it wasn't written right. And I'm like, yes, it is. It's the right software. And they're like, no, you don't even understand what we're talking about. You know, and I learned so much from every conversation I had with people. But I also, through a website called stage32.com,
yes.
I've hired some people who were pretty decent people in the industry to critique other screenplays I've written. And man, I loved how they were. They were like, listen, I'm going to treat you like one of our writers, not like somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. So I'm going to assume you know what you're doing, and I'm going to ask you why you're doing it.
Okay.
So she just grilled me over all these decisions I made in my script that she didn't make sense to her, and she explained why she didn't understand. So tell me. And I'm like, oh, I just didn't think of that. That's why.
Oh, yeah, that's my answer.
I don't know what I'm doing, I guess. Yeah. You know. But it's fun to see just what it takes to really get it right.
Yeah.
And so for you now, you're on screenplay number 7.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie you're doing in Nashville right now, or the movie that I saw the short clip of,
yeah.
is that your 7th script or is that an earlier script?
That is, that's my 7th, yes.
Okay.
So what you saw, we shot a proof of concept, you know, as we were and continue to look for funding. You know, you bring this thing on a silver platter and basically like say, here we have the look, we have the tone, and we have everybody that knows what we're doing. And
yeah, and if anybody out there is looking to finance film, check this out. I've seen this and it's really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, we shot that at my house in Nashville, actually.
Really? It looks great.
Thank you.
And what's the name of that film going to be?
Chameleon.
Okay.
Yes.
And where can people reach you if they want to check it out, or where can they see that?
Probably easiest to reach out because I'm not a huge social media person. The only social media I have is probably the Instagram page from my movie, which is Fronteras_movie. FRONTERAS.
Okay.
And then just directly at my email is probably best as well, which is norescues@gmail.com.
norescues@gmail.com.
Yep.
Okay. Now, Fronteras, what is that? Is that a film that's already out of yours?
That's the one that you talked to Steve Sherman about.
Okay.
And that was the one.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Yeah, man? Steve. What's up, brother? We shot that completely in Tucson. That's all Tucson. Brought my crew from Nashville over, and we spent a month in the desert. And mm-hmm. I thought it wouldn't be that hot in October, but turns out I was wrong.
So. You know, if you're in the sun mm-hmm. in the desert, it's going to be hot.
Yeah, but then we're doing overnights, you know, when we have to sleep outside, and suddenly it plunges to 30 degrees.
Yeah.
And so it's night and day difference for October.
So how did you get connected in Nashville? What was the impetus to get there?
After I graduated in 2014,
from Orlando,
pretty much all my people moved to Nashville as the industry was continuing to bloom, you know, for film and TV. And, I went and tried LA for about 5 months, absolutely hated it. And then, got invited to go to Nashville, and I was like, well, I know people there. So I packed up and went.
Okay. Yep. Was it a move to Nashville? So now you visit Arizona, or do you kind of have a place here and you go back and forth?
Both. So I have one in, you know, I have one in Nashville. I live with two of my college friends, and then Tucson. I'm here probably not as often as I'd like to be. I try to be here at least 4 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
So
you studied, I imagine when you were Full Sail, you studied film beyond screenwriting. You've studied directing as well?
Yeah, they give you the whole thing. Directing, they can vaguely do it, but I mean, until you're in the hot seat and right. know how to handle 5 decisions being thrown at you at once. So
essentially, that you hadn't done any film work before you went to school?
Correct.
So since then, you've done all of this stuff?
Yeah.
Now, working as a writer and directing, have you had an opportunity to direct anything that you didn't write?
No, I haven't got to that confidence level yet, and I don't know if I will. And that's mainly because as I'm writing, I'm building the image in my head, and I'm not sure I'd be able to do somebody else's writing any justice.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that they wouldn't be able to do something great. It's just I feel like I would deliver something underwhelming because it's not mine, exactly. So
I think if a story really inspired you and it was good writing,
sure.
that you would see it in a way, then it becomes a matter of mm-hmm. comparing what you see to what try to understand is this kind of what you see.
Yeah,
and I bet that's always a dance though during production.
It is. I mean, it's been nice because I'm not having to walk back and forth talking to a different writer and uh-huh. saying, "Is this what you had in mind? Like, is uh-huh. this the tone of how this person talks?" So I mean, that would add a completely different and new step to the whole production mm-hmm. process. So,
well, when you're writing, do you find that your experience as a director might limit the scene you're writing? Because you go, "Oh, I don't want to try and shoot that." Does that impact you in that way at all?
When you know when you know what the limit of the budget is already, kind of like on our first one, I wrote some of those scenes way too big,
right.
And then you get down to the money, and you're like, "Well, we need to. This is no longer going to be this location, and we're not going to have all these extras." So you have to kind of rewrite stuff on the fly or a week in advance,
right?
So, but I mean, I try to write within the budget I think we'll get, because, you know, that's how we avoid going over schedule,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is my worst nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, financing film. So you've had some experience at raising money for film.
Yes and no. The first one was completely self-funded by
right.
me and my cinematographer. So we split it right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we distributed it, we didn't actually start making money back on it until December of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So like three years later, we actually got returns.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, and not enough returns to cover the cost of making it, but you're saying finally get some money coming in?
Yeah, I mean, well, no, we broke even because we, you know, it got sold to Netflix as well and DVD sales. And so, I mean, I think now we've broken even.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as in that deal, I should say, did you find a distributor initially to take care of that, or did you do all that work yourself in terms of contacting Netflix and making the sale?
We had a sales agent reach out to us actually after we got into some kind of Low Ground Film Festival, and they saw our thing in the program and reached out to us, and we decided to work with him, and he cast the net out, and we just kind of decided which deal we wanted when they brought deals back to us.
That's kind of cool.
It was cool, because I mean, I don't have the key to that type of city, you know, with right. all the people that want to sign the checks and the papers.
So essentially, your path for that film was, you could say, was finding a sales agent.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't even know how to look for that. So thankfully, they kind of, it seems like they kind of canvas, you know, when film festival season comes around mm-hmm. and they look at what they think they can sell. And when, you know, my movie about Border Patrol is in a festival about like ballet dancers, and there's a bunch of other artsy stuff, and they had some really great stuff. But I mean, I just think I had the most commercially marketed movie there.
Right.
Yeah.
What was that festival?
Sunscreen Film Festival in Tampa, Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's a fairly large film festival, isn't it?
For that city, they had a pretty big turnout. I mean, they get an entire movie theater to themselves. And I think they screened us twice while we were there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that was cool.
Was that the first time you saw your own film on a big screen?
No. I premiered it here in Tucson for my friends and family at the Fox Theater downtown. Okay. And that was exhilarating. Things that you don't notice immediately stick out to you once there's other people in the room. And so all you can do is just sit in your seat, and that's it. So.
And take it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, no one else sees those things. You see them.
It's just me.
And a bigger thing, I think, too, once you get into that environment is, did it sound the way you expected it to sound?
It did, thankfully, because my cinematographer's brother, thank God his love and critique for audio, like, the audio was probably the most on point thing other than the camera work.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was really crisp, and we had not as much time as we wanted, but most of the attention got paid to making sure people's dialogue was crisp and mm-hmm. music and sound effects was good. So yeah.
That's huge. I mean, a lot mm-hmm. of directors talk about how the sound is the biggest part of the picture. I mean, when you get the sound wrong, it can destroy everything you've done.
It'll pull you right out of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But getting it right just can really sell it.
Yeah, we were able to have him go out and have another family friend of mine that has like an arsenal of weapons, and he just recorded live all day, just different guns, a couple explosions with like Tannerite and stuff. So it was all custom stuff, and I think it worked out really well.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So now in Nashville, there's a lot to talk about a music and sound community.
Mm-hmm.
So have you got some connections for post-production music and audio out of Nashville?
So, I mean, we do now. On the first one, it was just one guy doing everything, because I know he likes to compose before he does, like, more cleaning up of stuff. So he composed the whole movie, did everything else. But now,
it's incredible to get an original score for a film. It's just incredible.
Exactly. And I'm glad we got to do that. It was, I think it was a little daunting for him at first, because you know, he's like, well, tell me what you don't want. I'm like, I can do that. As far as what I want, you and me are gonna have to discover it as we go, brother. So
yeah.
But now he has a lot more connections, and I think going forward he can actually have his own department, as he should.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, for music in film, mm-hmm. in the ones you've made, has there ever been a piece of music that you then use as a placeholder, in a sense, or even want to listen to when you're writing or working?
Yeah. I mean, I listened to, what did I do? I like to listen to, I forget what, he just died not too long ago, Johan Johansson.
Okay.
Yeah. He scored like Sicario, Arrival.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And a few other things. And then my audio guy turned me on to another guy who composed like the latest Mad Max.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess whatever the tone of the story fits, I try to just listen to like original scores on loop, you know, or sometimes I just write in silence like a sociopath, you know, so sometimes that's what's needed.
Oh, no, I totally create in silence. I think my life is so full of sound mm-hmm. that I love silence. So, I mean, I drive with the radio off.
Yeah.
So do I. The quiet allows my mind to go, because my mind is grabbed by every single thing I hear
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I try and write with music playing, it totally has an impact.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it can help sometimes if I'm not writing dialogue and it's just action lines, and music is fine.
You know, writing dialogue, that's an interesting thing. Tell me if you feel you've had some sort of growth in being able to capture those voices as you've written more and more screenplays?
Yes. I have one of my actors that was in my movie. He's I trust him enough to show him early drafts of stuff. And I guess I used to have a problem where my dialogue sounded a little too, what's the word, like old-timey, you know? Like people just would talk way too, like I would write dialogue way too smooth and like people just don't.
Too formal?
Yeah, exactly.
Accurate?
Formal is the right word, exactly. So I tried to just pull that back as I go and trying to say more while saying less, you know?
Right.
Not doing like huge beefy dialogues because apparently, you know, that can stress an actor out.
It can. Well, and the truth is too, what you learn too as you do it is you can say as much with the look on the face. You don't have to say the words.
Exactly.
You write them on the page because you're trying to convey it to someone, but in reality you're going to convey it.
Yeah.
And then when you write your screenplay, it's hard to describe how you're conveying it visually.
Yep.
So the tendency is just write it into the words. But you know, often, and I found that when I first wrote, everybody sounded like me.
Yeah.
Everyone kept saying, you know, fantastic and awesome. And it's like, okay, they can't all have my personality.
Exactly. Yeah. They can't have your word choice.
Yeah. So that's difficult. So for me, it was difficult, having not done it a lot, to then go through the characters and go, well, how would they really say that?
Yeah.
So is that an exercise for you? Do you get help with that? Or?
First, I mean, I always try to limit my characters. I can't do like a whole Ocean's 11 cast and juggle that. So I think if I can keep it to like two or three main people with like, you know, background people that show up like for like a scene, then that's easier because then I can like just jump back and forth between mindsets. And then I try to think about, you know, where I am at the story, what's already happened to them, and, you know, kind of how, like, you know, you or me, like, your mood changes depending on how your day goes. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, but it's just, it's a lot of writing it, re-looking at it, and saying, what the hell was I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Just gut it completely, and then you end up with half of what you had, and it's, you still get the point across.
Are all of your screenplays thrillers, kind of? Is that your...
Yeah, I mean, I've done one that I'm pretty sure I'll never get to put on screen just because it'll probably be best as a graphic novel because it's an Area 51 thriller.
Uh-huh.
And just I feel like the dollar amount on that one would just be way too much.
Well, it depends on where you go with your career, right? I mean, it might be fun to take a
swing
at.
That's true. I'm saying that right now, but I'm, you know, trying to be realistic. I like to have a thriller element in all of them. Just something that continually moves the train,
mm-hmm.
But also not making it like continuous in your face, explosions and car chases and whatnot.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
There's a character you cast in this film coming up. An older gentleman. He plays an officer or a detective.
Guy with the mustache.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is that?
That is Steve Garland. He was also in my first movie.
Yeah, I know. I saw him in a clip in the other film.
Yep.
Is he out of Nashville?
He is out of Tampa, actually.
Tampa. Really liked him.
Yeah, fantastic.
In everything I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I liked all the actors and their work in what I saw you shoot. I think that your direction of the bits that I've seen is great, and the look is incredible. I'm just really excited to see that you get that film finished.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to have people do their jobs well enough that it makes me look good.
Well, it's everybody needs to, you know,
because
any one part falls down, it seems like that's what you see.
Yes, exactly. It just takes one tiny thing, and you're like, that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, how close are you to being on track to finish that film?
I mean, like, we can't start until I have the budget closed, just because I need to have everything in place. I can't do what you hear stories of people like, well, we'll shoot it half then, and then we'll take a month off, and then, like, the second half just never happens. And it's been tougher because, I mean... I've heard multiple times that your second feature is the hardest one, and I never understood what that meant until now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because after you do your first one, you accomplish it, but then you realize what not to do and that you need to actually probably over budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not self-funding it this time. Like, I can't do it.
Right.
So, and this one is actually a lot less ambitious than our first one was. We're not going across the country. We're not shooting at the border.
Right.
So...
do you have a line on raising money right now, or are you just knowing you got to get that next?
I'm just knowing I have to get that next. I haven't really reached out. I took a short trip to LA to meet a few contacts that I'd met when I lived there. That kind of fell on its face. That's a different story altogether. Okay. But I know the number that we need to hit, ideally. So. Mm-hmm.
What is it? Can I ask?
700K.
Okay.
Which I know is like pennies compared to what movies are made for. But when you don't really have any credibility,
right.
You know, you can't just reach out and say, here's what I need, give it to me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, after the next film, maybe you could be able to do that.
Yeah, maybe.
Fairly reasonable. Is that a conservative estimate, or has that got enough fat that you're confident you can make the film for them?
That's got enough fat. It's going to making sure all my people are paid, because nobody got paid on the first one.
Yeah.
So it's just, if I can't pay people because their time is worth something to me, then I'd rather not do it.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I completely understand that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, man, I'm excited about your film career moving forward, but I want to maybe get into this conversation about this book. But before we do, I'll give you a break here.
Sure.
We'll spin another song. Today, I'm kind of featuring all the music I wanted to play is just from one group out of the Forever Records catalog called Reckless Serenade. I think they're kind of cool, and they have an energy that kind of reminds me of your book. So I thought,
oh, thank you. I agree.
This would be kind of cool. So this next one is called Stranger Things on the Otto D Show, and then we'll be right back with my guest, Andrew Dean.
Listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And that was Stranger Things from the Fervor Records catalog and a band called Reckless Serenade here on the Otto D Show, where today my guest is Andrew Dean. We've been talking about his film career and the movies he's working on, and he's also an author. We're going to switch gears here now and kind of get into that. So earlier, Andrew, you mentioned that this book you've got coming out called Surfacing, that's coming out in April, mm-hmm. is an adaptation from one of your screenplays.
Yes, yes it is.
And so is this the first time you've taken one of your screenplays to turn it into a novel?
Yeah, it is. This is actually my first screenplay, but it's been on the shelf up until when I started adapting it until last year.
Well, my impression from what I've read of it is that you weren't thinking about film budget when you wrote that screenplay.
Oh, absolutely not. And that was what was great. I was just like, I just write it, I edit it, and then it's done.
Right,
and that's the end of the line, and then I put it out into the world, and my work is done there. So,
well, you mentioned earlier that you're a big Tom Clancy fan.
Love Tom Clancy.
What's your favorite Tom Clancy novel?
Oh boy, probably one of the longer ones, Rainbow Six.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know how hard it is to make a movie, and no disrespect to the people that worked on it, but I think they completely butchered Without Remorse on Amazon. I was just like. I watched it. I was like, oh, I haven't seen a Tom Clancy movie since. Have they done anything since Hunt for Red October of Tom Clancy?
Which, actually, I thought the movie was good, but I didn't read the book.
Okay, wait, which one?
Hunt for Red October.
Okay.
As an example.
Movie's great, but this newest one that they did, which was a Tom Clancy book, and I just really felt that they dropped the ball on my boy.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, a book... You get a long time to tell the story. In the movie, you get 90 minutes. It's really hard. They can condense. You condense characters. You have to cut through a lot of the...
I would kill for a 90-minute movie. I feel like everything now is 2.5 hours minimum.
Yeah,
I miss 90-minute movies. Yeah.
All right, so did his style, writing style, inspire your take on this new book?
It did. I mean, maybe not so much style, but the world that he kind of builds, and he's got characters that run on from book to book to book. And, I've always been interested in stuff like that, like really clandestine kind of behind closed doors type of stuff.
Well, he has a background that's military and so it's not, foreign, but, what's your background? Do you have, and where do you get this information for titling characters and where they are and the right, lingo?
A little bit of it is just research. And then I have family friends that I reach out to when I can get a hold of them just to confirm stuff. Cause the last thing I want to do is screw something up like a basic detail. And then it just pulls somebody that knows that right out of the book.
Right.
So it's just trying to do as much due diligence as I can. And I'm sure there's something in there that I, may have missed or didn't get right. But, hopefully not.
Well, it sounds like you have a real relationship to the background data.
Mm-hmm.
To me,
yeah. I mean, it's just probably from having read Clancy's work, watching movies and documentaries where they actually everyone on camera just talks this different language, and you just kind of pick things up.
Well, give me an overview of the story.
So the overview is it kind of bounces between three characters a little bit until they come together, and basically what it is it follows this kind of division within the CIA that normally hunts down people that have kind of gone against the country, but they're also American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically kind of sell out the country for the right dollar amount.
Right.
But the director of this division is very like older age, like boomer age. So in his eyes, the flag can do no wrong. Like, we're still all powerful, number one. And basically what happens is he's not happy that the pandemic has a cure. And his view is that every so often this wave of whatever needs to come through and thin the herd, like, the Black Plague, Spanish mm-hmm. flu did. So what happens is he decides to find the guy that developed this cure for the pandemic. And he's going to get rid of him because he finds out that he's developing these other life-saving cures that can continue to keep the population alive longer.
Right.
So he basically dispatches his, people that go and find these people and get rid of him. And, you know, there's the moral conflict of this guy who's been doing it for forever and can do it just stone face and cold heartedly. And this new recruit, they kind of clash heads, and you kind of have to accept where you're at now. And then they kind of have to use their skill set to get it done without getting caught. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a big moral dilemma when you read it. You know, it's just kind of how I wrote the character. He's like, he just believes that the population needs to get thinned, and he doesn't want basically America to get blamed for overpopulation, because he thinks that they've gotten the finger pointed at them on everything else. And right. He's like, if overpopulation happens, it's not going to be our flag as the ship goes down. So
interesting.
Yeah.
So now, where can people find this book when it's done?
It'll be on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple Books. Those are the three big ones. And then I put it on a few other up-and-coming distribution platforms. Yeah, those are the three big ones.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the first, like you mentioned, this is the first screenplay you've turned into a novel. But when we were playing the last song, you mentioned you're going to turn all of your screenplays into books.
I think so. I mean, I really enjoyed the process of it. It was kind of meditative. You know, I don't write at a fast pace. It was nice. I mean, I can write in a different person, like the second or third person, whereas screenplays is normally very straightforward, like this happens. I enjoyed being able to describe things more, people's personalities, the way they think. It was just kind of a nice, refreshing way to be able to write. So
bong bong, I'm moving some things around here. Check. I'm gonna change my microphone.
Fair enough.
Something happened on that one, but I think that when you take, it's kind of working backwards. We talked about compressing a book into a movie.
Yep.
But you're taking a screenplay, a 90-minute story, let's say, and stretching it out. So.
Yeah.
Kind of what I sensed in reading the first part of the book is that I got to, unlike a movie where you are convinced in the first 10 minutes whose arc you're writing with and you're supposed to buy into their story, in the book, all of a sudden you're with somebody else's story for the next few chapters. Mm-hmm. Then you're back to a new character and getting to know them. So you really get to dive in deeper into character development in a sense.
That's what I enjoyed a lot is that... I didn't really spend any time on like how people look. I mean, I kind of like you'll read them and you'll just kind of decide how they look in your head, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed being able to kind of like figure out what I wanted, just how do they talk, if they have any weird tics and stuff that I wouldn't have the time to do in like an on-screen medium.
Yeah.
You know,
I want to read the foreword to the book.
Please.
Because I thought it was comical.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah.
And then I want to ask you why you wrote this, but
please.
Just the forward says, for your safety, certain names, locations, and events have been declassified. In the unlikely event you have any relationship or knowledge to said persons, locations, or events, the author will deny any and all knowledge of your existence. Should you be found in possession of this text or taken into custody, you will be denied the right to a phone call, the right to an attorney, and face the United States justice system. You know what? I'm reading the second half of it before I read the first half of it, huh? Back here at the top, where it says, legally, I'm supposed to tell you this is a work of fiction. Legally, I'm supposed to tell you the names and characters and business events or incidents are the products of my imagination. Legally, I'm supposed to tell you any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, or actual events is purely coincidental. Legally, you're not obligated to believe any of the above is true.
Yep.
So that implies to me that, okay, this is real stuff. Or are you just saying that to get people to buy into it?
Yeah, I'm trying to like set the tone as early as I can because of the nature of the story and how like secret it's supposed to be.
Right.
I wanted like everything that I could, like the foreword, the copyright, to be kind of like seem like it's something that you're not
also,
supposed to be reading.
Also cloak and dagger.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Even my when I'm, you know, I have to have like an author page for all these other platforms. And when I go on like other podcasts in like March, and then I have a TV thing in Tennessee, the author picture I chose, it's like my passport photo, but I blacked out my eyes, like the cover of it. So
right.
I'm going to try and probably change what photo I use depending on what the book's tone is. So just kind of like morph with each story just to try and, cause I like setting the tone as early as I can and maintaining it. So
right,
yeah,
very cool. Now in this story, you did. You mentioned to me that even last week you made a bunch of changes, kind of.
Yeah, the last week, just when I thought I was done.
Just when you thought you were
done. I was
done.
Laying in bed, and I was like, damn, now I got to redo this whole thing.
How did that arrive? I mean, were you looking at it, or were you thinking about making the film, or what gave you this impetus that something needed to be changed?
No, I mean, the film version of it has pretty much taken a back seat right now, and I'm not thinking about doing that at all right now. I find myself constantly complaining how women have been portrayed lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss my Ellen Ripley's and my Sarah Connor types. Mm-hmm. Where they don't show up in the movies about, hey, I'm a woman, deal with it. It's just, here's the severity of the situation. The protagonist just happens to be a woman, and that's all we talk about of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the, you know, protagonist in Surfacing was originally a guy, and when I thought about it, I'm like, I could switch it to a woman and not have to switch anything else, how they talk, how they act, like, and now I got to do it because I can't stop thinking about it. So, mm-hmm.
Well, in this kind of story too, it's uncommon to have that character be a woman.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Because I was skipping ahead, I actually landed on that, mm-hmm. and I had to go back and check. Did he say her? Did he say her?
Yeah.
It's like, he did. Oh, cool. This is going to be interesting, because now I thought this could go a lot of places. But even if it doesn't change the story at all, it totally changes how it feels.
Yeah. I mean, you'll subconsciously look at the character differently, but I didn't. The character was never like a macho character, so I didn't have to like tone down the dialogue at all. It's just like, that's how they talk. This is their mindset. Their background is the same. I just thought, with how much I complain about it, like, why not try and take a stab at it myself? Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. I flip-flopped it the last week, found all the he's, added the s, and yep.
It's a lot of work.
It was. I had somebody else read it, and they highlight it, and they're like, here's where you missed change. And I was like, whoa, it was a ton.
Well, you really need another set of eyes, I think, when you do that kind of work.
Yeah, you stare at it, and you just kind of get hypnosis, and you just kind of skip through things.
Well, and you know what the line is supposed to be, so it reads that way in your mind as you go, as you scan through it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't make her what's called a Mary Sue. You know what that is? Or like the character shows up, and they automatically are an expert at everything.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, she has her skill set, and I explain why and where she obtained that. But for the most part, she does not know how to do anything else rightfully, because she hasn't been in this line of work that she's going into nearly as long as everybody else.
Right.
So I gave her disadvantages and struggles, I think, as any good character that you're supposed to care about has.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you just show up and they're just in God mode the entire time, and there's no stakes.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, when I first picked it up to take a glance, I really thought I would take a glance and kind of, please, I'll just see what it is and skip along. But I have to tell you, I got through the first 35 pages before I even put it down.
Oh, cool.
And it wasn't because it was fast paced. Mm-hmm. It's not fast paced. Mm-hmm. The pace is kind of gentle,
yeah.
but the pace of information being revealed was really nice.
Thank you.
I felt like every time you told me something, it was more interesting and more interesting. The character's interaction, the shift to the next character's focus.
Mm-hmm.
That pace I thought was really, really cool, really engaging.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And that's it's your first time. So, I mean, I felt like I could see you sitting there writing. I mean, I felt like you were just casual. It's very casual, just telling the story.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
It's weird. You know, I'm looking at the screenplay format of it, and basically probably 5 pages happens in 1 page on a screenplay, because you don't describe all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it was just tough, like, you know, extending one action line to like 3 paragraphs, because otherwise it just happens too fast. So that was probably the most difficult part.
It's like a real exercise.
It was, you know? Yeah.
Well, I think the other thing you get to do in the novel is you get to describe what people are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, that's against the rules in the screenplay.
Yeah. It has to be kind of open to interpretation to the actor.
You can say in the screenplay, he raised his eyebrow. Because that's what you see,
yep.
But you can't say what he thought that made him raise
exactly.
his eyebrow.
Exactly. So that was nice, too. And I'm like, huh, well, I never thought about what his mindset would be. So, that's why it kind of took as long as it did.
Yeah.
So,
How long has it taken you?
I started writing the novelization of it, let's see, summer of last year. So not that long, but I know people hammer out books way quicker. Right. So,
well, for a first one, I don't think, you know, that's pretty good.
True. I mean, I guess I had already had it written, so I knew all the story beats. So that kind of probably took 6 months off of it. Mm-hmm. But and then the dialogue was all there. So like I said, the last change was changing it to a female.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned to me earlier before the show that this is a self-published book. Yes. So tell me about that process for you. I mean, a lot of people are turning to that. A lot of people do. I did a self-published book, but
yeah,
how'd you get started with where to go?
I mean, YouTube. You look and you just kind of see like first steps, and thankfully people kind of do step-by-step guides on it. And it's really just kind of setting up your book and formatting it correctly to be able to go on to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And you get to kind of look at what your royalties will be. You get to price your book as much as you want. But then it's a weird dance. Like if you price it too high and you don't really have a following, like no one's going to buy your book because, you know, who the hell am I?
Right. So,
yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of learning which platforms you can put it on and kind of trying to juggle because their standards are differently mm-hmm. for what they want uploaded.
And so there's obviously, you know, the thing that really gets people aware of it is some sort of marketing campaign.
Yeah.
I know you're on doing interviews like this, and you mentioned a television interview when you get back into Nashville.
Yep.
Are you doing anything else in terms of your own? Are you financing a huge marketing campaign? I know it's...
I don't know how to do any of that, but all the money I had for the book, I tossed at a marketing team, and they pretty much... I told them what I wanted to do. They had different options, and I'm... They basically put together a press release for me. They're going to put that out to 200 podcasts. How many I actually get back for interviews is up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing the TV spot in Tennessee. Then I'm also doing a spread in New York Post in May.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So, tell me about that.
It wasn't cheap. But, I mean, I know the, you know, who doesn't look at the New York Post, you know, at least on the East Coast. So they're going to do like a full color spread on it with the cover, like a full page review on it. I think they're also going to put like 4 or 5 other books next to it. I don't really know what lineup I'll be in, but, you know, it'll be a physical thing.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So it's just the waiting game now because it's done. But I mean, it takes some time to build this stuff along sure. among with other clients, so it's kind of not going to start to unfold until late March through April and in May. So
if you get some success, you see a book tour in the future?
I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing how much heat I catch for the moral dilemma of the book.
Okay.
Because, you know, like I said, it's him stopping these people from making medical advances that will save people. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, life needs to end for life to continue, if that makes any sort of sense. The circle of life needs to make its rotation every so often. So,
right.
Yeah. But I think that's what makes any story compelling is if you can split the audience down the middle and kind of get them to look at both sides of the fence.
Well, and it gives you, I think if people have to be made a little uncomfortable by what you're saying.
Sure.
Because then they stay reading to find out what you're really saying.
Yeah.
It's kind of how they get engaged is to get them a little anxious or a little, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, it would probably read differently if, like, he was like, here's what you're going to do. And then everybody was just 100% on board. But it's just like it comes down from the top. And this one guy that you read about in chapter one, Teddy, which is my dog's name, by the way,
okay.
has to convince the girl, be like, well, you're here. You know, here's why we're doing it. Unfortunately, if you decide you don't want to do it, then we have to get rid of you. You can't just walk away because you
with
know
this information.
We know, you know, this place exists now.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's kind of, you know, she wants to serve her country in the most direct way possible, and unfortunately, this is kind of how she's fallen into it.
Right.
So,
yeah, I thought it was fascinating, the plus ones, the characters, and right off the bat, you're told, really? Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So it has its deep and dark right from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're clean and shop.
Yeah.
I mean, there's bad people everywhere.
That's true. It's very, very true.
Yeah.
So what's your next project once this is done,
mm-hmm.
while you're trying to get your film financing together for Chameleon, is it that?
Yes, sir.
What else you got going on, or what are you thinking about doing?
I mean, Chameleon, I've already started doing novelization for that.
Okay.
And then now that I know how to tackle it more efficiently, I should hopefully have that one out by the fall, I would think. And I'm just kind of taking it slow, because if I juggle too many things, then I feel like the quality is right. lacking if I'm divided too many ways.
Now, is that all you do, or your creative projects, or do you have production work you do for other clients too to pay the bills? Or
Every so often, I'll get thrown on a production piece with like my cinematographer, mm-hmm. if he needs to fill in, or sometimes I'll just be a production assistant. As much as I like movies, I absolutely hate being on set. I don't like how slow everything goes. I know why it takes that amount of time, but I'm a very anxious person. So, they're doing like minimum 12 to 14 hour days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough being at the bottom of the chain, watching somebody at the top not know how to do something you could decide right now.
Right.
Yeah. So it can be frustrating. So, I hold like a regular 9-to-5 job as well on the side, so mm-hmm. It's the way it is.
And that's in Nashville?
Yes.
Okay. How long are you back here this time?
I usually come back for 8 or 9 days, but then I get the itch about 3 days when I'm supposed to leave to just extend my flight another week. The last two times have been weather, so I'm like, oh no, I'm stuck here. But this time it looks like the weather's clear, so I'll have to decide if I want to extend on my own account.
Yeah. Hey, you were born in Tucson.
I was born in San Diego, but I lived there, I think, a year.
Okay.
Don't remember it.
Okay. So you grew up in Tucson?
Yes.
And you stayed until you went to school in Florida?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then you went to Nashville from there? Oh, well, you came back here for a bit.
Yeah.
Or you went to L.A.?
I went to L.A. for about 5 months at the end of 2014 into 2015. Yeah.
Now, how do you like Nashville? I mean, besides production.
Oh, I absolutely hate that city.
Do you really?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just the country music. I mean, you can avoid country music. It's just everyone from all four corners of the country is moving to Nashville because it's the it city for some reason.
Right.
Don't know why. It's way too small for how many people are moving there. I'm in the trifecta of bad weather. I get Florida and Georgia's humidity. I get the snow from the East Coast, and I get tornadoes from Oklahoma. So it's a real pleasure, but I absolutely hate Nashville, and I cannot seem to get out of there for some reason.
That's funny.
But my people are there, so that's what makes it bearable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I went, first time I went to Nashville, I felt it seemed like a really big Peoria, Illinois, which is where I was from.
Okay.
So it felt like home, just really big.
My mom's from Joliet.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if those are closest or.
It's a little closer to Chicago, but
okay. Yeah.
But it's very Midwest. Nashville's very like those Midwest towns. And you're right. I mean, the weather and then the tornadoes, that's why I'm here.
Yeah. Know? No, And first, it's not cheap here, but it's cheaper than Nashville.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would like to find a way out of there sometime this year, if not the beginning of next year.
And if you do get out of Nashville or make a move, is it back to Arizona, you think?
Absolutely.
Okay.
100%.
Do you have a team here, a production team, or would you have to kind of get back into it and grow that group?
I probably wouldn't grow it anymore. I mean, I would, if I, you know, if the movie ever happened, I've got my people over there and I would just go to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get deep roots with the right people. And if I tried to get new people, I would just be comparing them to the people I already love and have a rapport with.
Yeah.
So,
and it's kind of like you already have a silent language. They know mm-hmm. what you, your process and what you do. So
yeah, exactly.
A lot can go unsaid.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've got their hands, busy hand over fist there with work.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's cool. Well, listen, man, I'm going to let you go. I want to thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
And Chameleon, I can't wait to see the movie.
Yeah, me too.
So I want you to, get on that funding.
I know. I if anybody wants to help me.
let's get that movie made because that looks really, really great. And again, to see that someplace, the easiest way is to...
Yeah, my Instagram at fronteras_movie or my email directly is at norescues@gmail.com.
Cool. Yeah. And then Surfacing will be out in April.
April 10th.
So be sure to check that out, especially if you're a Tom Clancy fan. You got to read this book. I think you're going to love it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Andrew, man. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your stay in Arizona.
Thank you.
And have safe travels back to Nashville.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for listening today to The Auto D Show, where my guest has been Andrew Dean. And like I said before, be sure to check out his new book coming out called Surfacing. And I will see you next week. Take care.